It's my pleasure to introduce Alison, who will take today's workshop, who will share her experience, strength and hope on realising the promises. Thanks very much.
Oh, good morning, everybody. Alison here, really grateful, recovering under owner with all of you right now. If you're in these rooms, if you're in this room today, you have begun your recovery. I'm feeling a little nervous because I can't be in the room actually with you all. And I tried to scroll through my bar to see how many and all your faces. And there were so many people, I kind of got scared that I'd get lost. And so I came back to where my opening screen. I just want to quickly say some meeting norms. For me, the meeting room is a sacred place. It's such a sacred place that I don't bring to my phone UA meetings, which is how I do most of my UA meeting work. And of course, now to a Zoom meeting, I don't bring my office filing and I don't bring my preparations for breakfast. I really try to come to the meeting space as I would if I were in a face-to-face meeting, so I can honor and enjoy that sacred space. So I'm just wishing that for everybody today. And welcome so much today to the newcomers. We're so glad you're here. Our program is built on newcomers, and you are the most important people in the room today. So I want to talk quickly about the problem. Who was I prior to recovery in this program? I came in with many, many years, decades of solid recovery and other 12-step program. I have a loving marriage. I have a wonderful son. And yet my disease of under-earning was absolutely flourishing. I worked in spurts. I negotiated with my husband prior to our marriage. I wanted to be a full-time mom, and if I got pregnant, and I wanted to be able to work also. So I sort of wanted to have it all. I'll just quickly say, being a full-time mother was very important to me. Part of my history, my father was alcoholic. My mother was schizophrenic, and so I did not have a mother. She spent years, most of her life in institutions. I'm the second youngest of six, but so by the time I was conceived, you know, the family had, because we hadn't received any help, deteriorated. And when I was born, she went back into the institution 3 days after I was born. And I was looked after by my 10-year-old sister. And she was struggling, being incested by my father. And I'm also an incest survivor. So being a mother was important. And I negotiated that through some good recovery and other programs. So I had all these incredible symptoms that were so beautifully illustrated on the screen today and read. I'm indifference. I mean, I could certainly get a job done, but I didn't really use my time to focus on my vision and goals. Although my vision to have a strong family and to have a loving marriage and children was certainly something I was fully committed to. The professional side of my life was different. Idea deflection. I was the queen of idea deflection. Before the thought was even finished being spoken, I would bat that idea away. My son would even comment on it. My husband commented on all the time, because people were always offering me fabulous ideas as to how I could be successful in whatever endeavor it was, you know, idea number 5,580. That I had come up with to be fully who I am. The compulsive need to prove. I was really ugly at that, and I've come to understand the full flavor of this symptom. It's really about my deep, deep fear of humans. And I just felt so worthless that no matter what you opened your mouth with in terms of a human interaction, I felt I had to prove that somehow I was worthy and could top your story, that somehow that would make you like me, or somehow that would have me fit in. And of course, what it did was it made me a really awful person to be around. Because let me tell you guys, there's not one story anyone here can tell unless you're an astronaut. Although I have done aerobatics in a small plane twice. But if you're an astronaut, I can't top that story. But it was awful. It was so awful. And I felt so alone and worthless behind all that proving. Anyway, I could just continue to go through all these wonderful identification statements of the symptoms of this really painful, debilitating disease. I want to talk about I missed my little place here. I was thinking of something else. I don't know. I just want to check again that I'm not missing something here. I didn't do stability boredom when I was bored. How I did stability boredom was when I was frightened, and pretty much I was frightened at any time I was working with people. If something was a little odd, or I was asked a question, or maybe felt in myself that I wasn't doing as good a job as I wanted to. And what I would do is just throw out, I described it early in recovery as just throwing out a hand grenade. I would just do something in the room that would literally explode the whole place. And while everyone was like freaking out and getting their act together and trying to figure out what to do next, I could regroup because I was used to that kind of chaos. And of course, I'd thrown the grenade. So, and I didn't give a F. I'm not going to swear today. I didn't give an F whether I went down in that throwing of the hand grenade, because at that moment in time, I was so terrified and felt so worthless. I was just going to, didn't matter if we all died, metaphorically, of course. So that was another reason that I was really awful to be around. And most people didn't kind of understand that I did that, but somehow people just didn't feel that good around me. So anyway, you can imagine that when I got to this program, when I was 12, stepped into this program, even with, I must have had about 26 years of solid recovery and realizing the promises in those programs. But you can imagine, I just wasn't a nice person. And I wanted to be nice. I really was working to be nice. It was something I focused on from a very early child. I did always want to be a kind, nice, decent, loving, sweet person. In fact, my father suicided when I was 15 and a half, and I was the last child, sibling, to see him alive. And I really believed deeply that if I had have told him then how much I loved him, despite his horrific behavior and his disease of alcoholism and his under-earning disease, that he may not have suicided. And so I had this really deep belief in being loving and kind, and yet I could not actualize that as a person. I lived, it was sort of a very, I might want to say kind of a bipolar life, because life in many ways was really wonderful. And yet, within who I wanted to be professionally and who I saw myself as a person, I was extremely depressed about that and very unhappy. And this, as I said, the symptoms, the way I used the symptoms, certainly did not make me the decent person that I know I am. So, Debbie, I'd like to move on. I'm going to move on to, I'm not sure timing-wise where I am. I think I'm moving into talking about recovery, and hopefully I haven't talked too long on the problem. So for me, the tools, you know, time recording, meetings, sponsorship, the first three tools that we talk about to begin on day one were really, really key. And when I did my time recording, I was floored to see how little time I actually spent for myself. I certainly, because I could do phone meetings, was able to do my 90 and 90. That's a meeting a day for 90 days, utilizing the phone tool. And then, of course, that just turned into a 360 blah, blah, because it was just so fabulous. It was so fabulous to be in a room with people whom I could completely identify with and not to be the only asshole in the room. I was in a room, I could hear the disease. I could hear it in tone of voice. I could hear it when I first got on that first meeting. It was truly revelatory. People were, I don't know. Debbie's just sent me a message, but I'm not sure what it means. It was just truly revelatory and such a blessing. Possession consciousness, really a key tool. And for me, possession consciousness didn't come around my home. I already keep a very clean, tidy home. I could, as a mother or as a manager of a home, I never saw my mother do anything. She couldn't cook. She couldn't do anything. She was very intellectually amazing and an amazing woman, but she couldn't organize or do anything. My house is very organized. but the possession consciousness that I needed to do was around my threadbare ideas. And I had so many big plans. And of course, some of them were funded and many of them were not. They were just fantasies. They were, you know, an idea without funding is a fantasy. And in fact, one of my other diseases that I have very solid, thank you God, one day at a time recovery in, was all based on fantasy. So of course my working life was based on fantasy. And I just thought that I would find the right idea and one day I'd be famous and worth millions and millions and millions. So I did a lot of possession consciousness and the fourth step is possession consciousness in this program. I'm just going to quickly read from the 12 and 12 on page 47. It says, we thought conditions drove us to drink. We thought conditions drove us to think. And when we tried to correct these conditions, we found we couldn't to our entire satisfaction. Our thinking went out of hand and we became under-earners. It never occurred to us that we needed to change ourselves to meet the conditions, whatever they were. And then it goes on to say, but in UA, we slowly learned that something had to be done about our vengeful resentments, self-pity, unwarranted pride. We had to see that every time we played the big shot, we turned people against us. I played the big shot a lot. We had to see that when we harbored grudges and planned for revenge for such defeats, we were really beating ourselves with a club of anger intended to hurt others. We learned that we were seriously disturbed And our first need was to quiet that disturbance. And then the other reading I'm just going to bring here is from our big book. These are both conference approved, UA conference approved literature for UA. And this is on page 66 from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it says, we began to see that the world and its people really dominated us. And that was staggering to me, the truth, when I did this fourth step in UA, that I really did, was dominated, because I was such a dominating personality. I had no idea that I was being dominated. Anyway, I just am so grateful for the recovery. And I'm asking Debbie, can you just give me a hand show of how much time I have?
You have.
Great.
Sorry, I couldn't unmute myself before. You have another 6 minutes, Alison.
Perfect. Great. I thought I was messing up totally, but I'm not messing up totally, guys, because...
Doing wonderfully. Thank you.
Thank you. So working with all those threadbare ideas I had, what I came to understand, and I'd understood this before UA, and I'll say I'm in my 10th year, and I'll be beginning my 12th year in August this year. 11th year in August. So when I came to UA, UA was 5 years old, I knew I had a huge fear of money, and in another program that vaguely dealt with under-earning, I had done an inventory and understood that actually when I looked at my working history, I earned way better when I was working with groups of people. But still, because I really could never quite reach my potential in some ways working with groups of people. I would always mess it up, create absolute havoc, probably at about 18 months, and then things would deteriorate, and then I'd leave pretty quickly. But I could see in my earning history that when I was trying to produce one of these ideas that would make me world famous and produce millions of dollars, that I would earn like $2,000 in that year, as opposed to tens of thousands of dollars when I'd be working with others. A real change in my understanding. And I was offered at the time with my UA sponsor, because of course sponsorship is key. I'm hoping everyone here today will, they don't have a sponsor, be finding a sponsor and asking and receiving the gift of having a sponsor. I'm not a believer that it's hard to find sponsors in this program. I think that that's a self-fulfilling belief. My sponsor, my first sponsor in UA, insisted that I keep doing the job that was an under-earning job. I was working for a community college as a teacher adjunct. I am a clothing designer by profession. And while it was fulfilling in terms of joy, it was monetarily not great. I had been doing small infill building development for my husband and I, and I'd had some partners, and I'd been successful in that. But she insisted I stay as I worked the steps because it had prestige. Being a professor has prestige. And lo and behold, what came up from that pretty immediately when I agreed, you know, when I submitted to the practice of working the steps and listening to what my sponsor was suggesting, I managed to secure a fellowship at Stanford University to write a paper for them, write some teaching units on human rights in the fashion industry. Human rights was a big concern of mine in the fashion industry, and rightly so, the lack thereof. And so that was very prestigious. So here I was, you know, earning this minuscule amount per week, and yet I'm being paid by a very prestigious university to do something close and passionate to my heart. And, you know, one thing led to another. I talked to my chair of the department at the college about my fellow with Stanford, and happened to get over my fear and say to her, look, I'd like to, and shame. I always carried a lot of shame around money. Money was one of the sicknesses in our family. There was none. To the fact that illustration of my father stole literally 5 pennies or 6 pennies. I had one of those little money boxes that was given to us for free from the bank, you know, all tin, you couldn't open it. I knew there was about 5 pennies because you could shake it and hear it. I'd given them to him. I took my sibs to giving it to him to mind, because, you know, I was always caretaking even from age 5. And when we came to shake them one day to hear how much we'd amassed, he had prized open my sister and my little money box and literally walked off with probably a total of 15 pennies that he never returned, never spoke of. And I wasn't so upset about my little 7 pennies or whatever I had. It was the shame. It was the shame for me. I remember going out into my yard in Sydney, Australia, out in the backyard, beautiful backyard, and kicking around this prized open free little money box from the bank and just weeping for the shame that I had a father who needed to steal from his kid 5 or 6 pennies. So, anyway, so when I talk about money, you know, all this misplaced guilt and shame, the symptom, being unable to ask for. So I did. I sat there and said, I'd love more work. And it wasn't as if we couldn't pay our bills. You know, I created a prosperous life. It was what I couldn't do personally, what I couldn't do for myself personally. And my dean of the, chair of the department said, funny you should ask. And there was a job going in career education at the college. I applied, I got that. My salary increased because I went from 3 hours a week to 16. And I was being paid at a pretty good level. And then that then just continued on to me being asked to work in the vice president's office doing a very special project, which I did for the last 3 years until the beginning of this year, doing something that I loved, bringing college classes to high school campuses in our country in California. So students could in high school also attain the first and possibly second year of college before they left high school. And for me, this was a real blessing growing up poor. The cost of education in this country is insane. I mean, it's not even funny. It's really bizarre. So if I could save families and young people 2 years of college, which in this country can be something like $80,000, you know, it's ridiculous. Then that was a blessing. I was very passionate about it. And it was very high profile.
Alison's giving you a 2-minute prompt.
Thank you. It was a very high profile job within the college. And what was really staggering is, you know, the symptom of physical ailments. I discovered that when the vice president would come to speak to me about my work, I literally would be like this. I couldn't speak. I was so nervous. And so, you know, we might think that we don't have all the symptoms, but let me tell you, they're there and they're just waiting for an opportunity to appear. I'm just so grateful to this program and to the joy. I'm now retired, probably because of the work I was doing now was with large groups, and I've realized I'm quite happy to be retired and think about what I'm going to do in this next chapter of my life. So I'm going to just read the set-aside prayer to close, and that is, consciousness, please help me to set aside everything I think I know about myself, my ability to earn, about the 12 steps, and especially you, so I may have an open mind and a new experience of all these things. Please let me see the truth. Thank you.